From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
We don't know what's going to be needed come January. That limits our investment opportunities. We're still making money for the people of the state, but we're bringing in less money than we could if we had a more functional government.
Don't pick fights with Gold Star families. That's wrong. We should just say thank you for their sacrifice. And these are the things that he's going to have to learn as a new candidate. And I think the American people will give him the benefit of the doubt if he shows that he does. But he's going to have to do it and do it quickly because there's only less than 100 days left before Election Day.
95 days left before Election Day, to be precise, at least as we go to air on Friday. That was Congressman Rodney Davis, one of many Republican officials who yet again found themselves answering questions about the latest controversy surrounding the party's presidential nominee, Donald Trump. Before that, we heard Illinois Treasurer Mike Frericks on another effect of the budget impasse. Illinois is missing out on investment income. We'll talk about that and much more this week on State Week. I'm Brian Mackey. With me in studio in Springfield is Kent Redfield. He's an emeritus professor of political science at the University of Illinois Springfield and a longtime observer of Illinois politics. And joining us on the line from the Illinois State Capitol Building, our State House Bureau, Amanda Vinicky, State House Bureau Chief for NPR Illinois and Illinois Public Radio, and Matt Dietrich, the editor of Reboot Illinois. Matt, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Brian.
So, Matt, Amanda, I'll begin with you. Continued reverberations from the Republican presidential nominee here in Illinois. We heard audio a moment ago from Congressman Rodney Davis. Also some news from Congressman Adam Kinzinger this week.
Right. Adam Kinzinger was became the latest Republican to defect from the Trump support trip from supporting Donald Trump. And Brian, what kind of struck me this week and actually in the last couple of weeks was just the vivid contrast between back in May in Peoria, the Illinois Republican Party held its state convention. And kind of the theme that day was that the party was accepting that Donald Trump would be the nominee. And in the weeks leading up to that, the big controversy was, would the Illinois Republican Party defect and send its delegates to Cleveland to not back Trump? And back in May at the state convention, it was all unity. They were finally accepting it, and they were actually putting a positive spin on it. You know, Trump really drove voter turnout in the primary. He could probably do the same thing in the general election. That was the theme that day. Well, since Trump's statements last week, we've just seen a steady flow of Republicans abandoning, and Adam Kinzinger became the latest. The highest profile, of course, in Illinois was Mark Kirk.
You know, I mean, what's been interesting, of course, coming from the RNC in Cleveland, it was both, on one hand, party unity, we're in this together, and at the same time, when you had members of Congress who were the few elected officials from Illinois, as we've talked about, you know, Leslie Munger, the comptroller, Governor Bruce Rauner wasn't there, when the congressional critters came on up, they did not steadily endorse Donald Trump. So you heard, I feel like Adam Kinzinger, for example, it's been wishy-washy, kind of, or maybe you would describe it as having your cake, eating it too. I don't know, where he, at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland, where you have basically a lot of Trump supporters, delegates who'd gone door to door, care enough about him, big fans of Donald Trump. They have a speaker before them and it almost ignoring the issue or walking lightly around it and talking about, you know, party support and we've got to win November, but not saying anything about Donald Trump. And then Kinzinger's most recent comments on CNN. I think it shows the difficulty with which Republicans are having to kind of straddle these, whatever, I don't even want to say two different sides of the party. Perhaps it's two different sides of themselves. Kinzinger's comment saying, you know, I'm an American before I'm a Republican. He is a veteran. I mean, all of that that goes into these equations where it is just a new face of presidential politics, period.
And Kent, we're seeing this up and down the ticket, right? Because Trump has obviously energized some number of Republican voters. They're very excited about him. On the other hand, he says things that make a lot of other Republicans and Democrats as well cringe, going, you know, with this whole line of attack against this Gold Star set of parents. And if people, if somehow you are listening to this show but are not familiar with what happened, there was a set of Muslim American parents who spoke at the last day of the Democratic National Convention. Their son had been an army officer who was killed in Iraq, and this the father spoke out pretty forcefully against Donald Trump, asked if Trump had ever read the Constitution, waved a little pocket copy of the Constitution. It was a moment that's probably going to be one of those historical moments we think back on when we think of conventions in the future. And Trump really kind of went on the attack against these parents, and that has caused a really revulsion from a lot of members of his party.
Yeah, I mean, there were a series of things there. The Gold Star family was the most, you know, the most prominent. And what we don't know at this point, I mean, obviously, you know, Secretary Clinton got a nice bump out of her convention, and now that seems to be extended even more. And so we don't know whether this is kind of the normal politics and things will come back, or whether, you know, sometimes what happens in American presidential elections is, you know, the conventions is a point where people kind of look at candidates with a set of fresh eyes, or people that haven't been looking start to look. And so, you know, can Donald Trump go beyond that high 30s kind of percent that seem to be a really core supporters to get the independents, to get the Republicans that are, you know, wavering? And the real danger here, and if you looked at, there was a poll this morning that had Hillary Clinton leading by 4 points in Georgia. Now, if Georgia is in play for the Democrats, since I can't remember, you know, the last time the
Democrats. Jimmy Carter, maybe?
Yeah, maybe.
I don't know.
Yeah, I assume Carter probably won his home state, but I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah.
You know, and then that starts to look at, if you've got energized Democrats and depressed Republicans, you're starting to have an impact on turnout. Illinois is a very Democratic state in presidential elections. Democrats usually do well up and down the ballot. And we should also note, you know, the congressman from the 10th district, Dolt. I mean, those, you know, the two most vulnerable Republicans were the congressman from the 10th and the U.S. senator, and they have never been on a board with Trump. They, you know, they know what Illinois looks like. And so, you know, is this temporary, or are we seeing, you know, something that, that really has legs, at least until the debates?
Yeah, and of course, Trump this week also saying that he was still on the fence or not quite there yet in terms of endorsing the Speaker of the United States House of Representatives, who, of course, is a Republican. Well, so Democrats are optimistic that the Trump-sparked controversy and sort of disarray within the Republican Party might help their chances this fall. As Kent just pointed out, Illinois is a pretty blue state, but Republicans are not taking chances. We've seen a lot of paid television ads ramping up. This is pretty early for that, too.
Certainly, yeah. I mean, to go on TV in you know, July and August is pretty unprecedented. And we're not only talking about the attack ads that have been run in southern Illinois and in, you know, against Democrats in the deep southern Illinois and some swing districts Democrats are in, like, you know, Representative Coonan in Kankakee. But we've seen money being spent on Roger McAuliffe in I almost called him his dad, of course, who was there before, but McAuliffe in Chicago on Chicago TV. And then we've seen expenditures for what you would think would be kind of the targets that the Democrats might go after. And so it just shows the fact the Republicans, you know, they've got a plan. They know where their weaknesses are. They know where they want to attack. And they're just going to spend money between now and November to try and counteract the fact that it's a Democratic state, a Democratic map, a presidential year, and, you know, perhaps, you know, an election that's not going to go the Republicans' way.
Right. And Kent, I could add there, too, not only do they have a plan and not only do they have targets, but this time they've got money, and they've got money like we have never, ever seen before in Illinois. Bruce Rauner right now has $15 million in his campaign fund. That's down from $20 million just a month or so ago, and that's because a lot of that money was spread out, given to the Republican Party, passed around to the House organization. You're going to see that money really start to flow. And the thing about having Bruce Rauner at the as the de facto head of the Republican Party is that he can replenish that fund anytime he wants with amounts that, for all practical purposes, it's limitless. And we have never seen this kind of money flow into Illinois politics before. We're going to see some small local House races that just blow spending records out of the water like we've never seen before.
I think that's a great point to emphasize, Matt. I mean, people talk about how much money the governor has in his campaign fund, but it's I mean, he just parked that money there. It seems like it was an arbitrary selection. He sort of donated, what, I think $10 million or so after he...
Almost a message. Look what
right,
I can do.
Right.
He donated $10 million on the last day, on December 31st, 2014, which I interpreted that as being the last day of the previous election cycle, so he could space it out and not take the limits off under Illinois election law. Once you put in, I think, $250,000, you're considered self-funding, so any opponent then doesn't have...
Don't give them any little advantage in their fundraising to stack up against your millions.
And it was also the case that because... with a quirk in Illinois' law, when the limits come off, they stay off until January 1st of a general election. And so Ken Griffin donated $8 million and Richard Uihlein donated $2 million. And so there was $20 million put into that fund right at the end of December. I mean, if you look at, say, for instance, Scott Kennedy has a really good website, Election Data, that is, you know, where he's looking at money currently on hand. And we're looking at $60 million showing. Obviously, the Democrats can't replenish that money as quickly as the Republicans. $30 million on each side, $60 million. That's, we're going to look at spending way beyond what we've ever had. And we have to remember, we just went through a primary where we spent $6 million on a primary for a House race. You know, it's got maybe 120,000 people in that district.
Yeah, I think we should just emphasize that point. A House race. We're not talking about all the House primaries. We're talking about a single race.
Yeah. And for contrast, the state's attorney's primary in Chicago with 5 million voters plus, the three candidates spent about 5.5 million, and the two candidates in this House race spent more than six. I mean, and so it is going to be crazy. Now, there's a point at which you get diminishing returns. You know, if you get five mailers on one day, the sixth mailer probably doesn't make any difference, or, you know, and you've already turned off your TV because you're so sick of the TV commercials. But it also buys organization.
And isn't that true even on TV, though, that as long as both sides are sort of adequately funded, that these things tend to be somewhat of a wash? I mean,
if you get outspent 2-1, 3-1, it's not necessarily fatal if your one is big enough. Sam McCann got outspent 3-1, you know, but...
Pat Quinn got outspent 2-1.
Yeah, but there's a point you can get buried.
Yeah.
You know, Judy Bar Topinka running against Rod Blagojevich. Rod Blagojevich outspent her in TV ads, probably 6-1. Post-election exit polls, if you were concerned about corruption in Illinois politics, you were slightly more likely to vote for Rod Blagojevich than Judy Bar Topinka. I mean, he just buried her with money.
Yeah.
Well, and let me be clear. I think the message that we need to take away from all of this money is we will continue to see ads going up and dollars spent and flowing to and from campaign funds from now probably until for the length of Governor Bruce Rauner's term, not just through the election, is really that the effect that this has. When you look at the budget situation and when people say, we want our politicians to get along, we want them to compromise, we want them to get together, when you have this money sitting there, it is not an elephant in the room. It is stacks of gold coins right in the center of it. And that makes, I think, everything all the more difficult. And there are policy reasons for sure why both Republicans and Democrats want what they want and why they have opposed the other side's agendas. And yet the money here is also a very big part of it, and why I think you've seen the hesitancy and the lack of willingness to really give it a go on the part of Democrats, because Rauner signaled before he even took over as governor what he was willing to spend to bury them.
Hesitancy to give it a go, you mean to, in terms of coming to some sort of legislative compromise?
Yeah, I mean, maybe not either to compromise or to take the governor at his word to give him any wins.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is State Week. Our panel is Kent Redfield, Amanda Vinicky, and Matt Dietrich of Reboot Illinois. I'm Brian Mackey. Something else that happened on the electoral front this week, I guess the Illinois Policy Institute, they are a conservative think tank, even though they profess to be nonpartisan. They've filed a lawsuit this week, or I should say an affiliate of theirs, I want to be precise here, filed a lawsuit over same-day voter registration in Illinois. Amanda, can you talk a little bit about what is same-day voter registration here? And
I'm actually going to pass this one off to Matt, because he's been following it.
Same-day voter registration went into effect, really got its first tryout in the primary back in March. This was a law that was passed in 2014 with all Democratic votes, and it allows you to vote. If you are not registered to vote, you can go register on election day to vote in that day's election. Now, you have to do it at your I'm drawing a blank now on the location where you have to do it, but you have to go to
your precinct,
your precinct. And that's the key, though,
is that at least in the bigger counties in Illinois, counties with a greater than 100,000 population, I think you have to go to your precinct. And if it's a smaller county, you can go to it. They don't have to necessarily have this at every single voting location.
Right.
You can just have it in a central, the county clerk's office.
Correct. Yes. That's right. And the argument in this lawsuit is that this is unfair, and that this deprives people in counties of fewer than 100,000 people because they have a different rule, that this deprives voters in counties of fewer than 100,000 people of a right that is afforded to the voters in the larger counties. So the Illinois Policy Institute's legal arm is trying to seek to enjoin this and not have it be in effect for the November election.
Which is actually kind of the ironic part of this is, as we talked about, this is an entity that is very conservative and very much about the state government spending less money. And part of the reason, from my recollection, of why the law was set up this way was after there had been very long lines and confusion and some problems with same-day voter registration, this was seen as kind of the common sense tact in a place where when you had really excessive lines in Chicago, voters staying in line until 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, then this would be a way where you would have more ability for voters to go to their polling place and be able to same day voter registration in their own precinct versus in some of these lesser populated areas where there wouldn't be as many resources. Okay, just one location is necessary. People can go there. There weren't these same issues with the lines and such. And so it is sort of ironic because, again, this is an entity that is always about saving money, and what they're saying is unfair. It was actually kind of the legislature's way of not putting an extra burdensome cost on these lesser populated counties while nonetheless taking care of issues that had arisen with same-day voter registration.
Right. And it also, in the press release that accompanied the announcement of this lawsuit, the Illinois Policy Institute's always been very emphatic about that they are nonpartisan. Now, they are very conservative and libertarian, but in the press release, they pointed out that the higher population counties in Illinois tend to favor Democratic candidates, whereas the low population counties, where it might be harder for voters to do same-day registration, tend to favor Republicans. So this is an element of, they're really injecting themselves into one of the big hot button issues of partisan politics.
And this is basically, they're making an equal protection argument in the suit. They're saying, you're differentiating in ways that are not fair. Well, you know, if we there, it is not uncommon in Illinois to distinguish between, you know, how you administer a law in terms of the size of the counties. And we do that all the time in terms of a whole bunch of functions in terms of how we deal with these kinds of issues. What makes it complicated, you know, in terms of the conflicting legal arguments, is this is about voting. And so, you know,
it sort of elevates it to a more constitutional realm, whereas if you're just mandating some administrative rule or the way, cities and counties administer traffic rules or something like that.
And so then do you have to have more, you know, a higher level of scrutiny in terms of saying, did the legislature make a reasonable judgment in terms of distinguishing A from B? Legislatures distinguish A from B all the time, and there's nothing wrong with that unless it's done in ways that are discriminatory or in ways, you know, intentionally or in ways that inadvertently result in a reduction of basic rights. And so it will be an interesting, you know, from that standpoint, it's an interesting case. It's, you know, you could have, I guess, approached this from the other direction and sued to make it mandatory in all counties that it had to be at a precinct level rather than going at it from this direction. But, you know, I'm not running their legal strategy.
No, yeah. And I mean, well, so let's take a broader look at this, though, because this is part of an ongoing fight between Democrats and Republicans over the rules of how easy is it to vote? How hard is it to vote? I mean, if you go back historically, you can get into the Jim Crow stuff where in the South, there were a lot of rules set up to make it very difficult for African Americans to exercise their right to vote. We had poll tests and poll taxes and things like that. We sort of moved beyond that, in our law. And now we have, the fronts. If you're a Republican state, you're maybe putting in voter ID laws, and those have been subject to constitutional challenges. And the idea there, the critics would say that disenfranchises minorities, college students, people who would be less likely to be on top of and, you know, able to have IDs. Sometimes what you have to pay for, you have to go to an office. If you don't have a car, that can be challenging. If you're on the Democratic side, you're trying to make it as easy as possible to vote. And the criticism there from Republicans is, come on, we're talking about voting. You can't get to the register 28 days ahead of time or whatever the law used to be. That's not that hard. This is a very important civic duty. You should register for it. This is an ongoing fight here.
Right. And we've seen a set of recent court decisions involving North Carolina. There was an agreement on the Texas law to scale it back and put the lawsuit on hold. And so, you know, where the courts find intentional discrimination, you know, and there certainly was a finding of that in one of these cases where essentially the legislature sought information about what kinds of IDs different classes, kinds of people have, minorities by age, gender, the population, those sorts of things, and then accepted, you know, disallowed all of the IDs that Democrats and minorities would be more likely to have and kept the ones that would be more likely for, you know, white middle class people to have. And the judge was very critical about that. So, you know, my guess is this was put in there to, as Amanda said, this is what we're doing is we're trying to not have an unfunded mandate, reduce the costs, but we're going to be caught up in a legal argument. And certainly the Democrats have tried. I mean, they amended the law before to increase voter registration and polling that specifically affected college campuses and not other places. And that clearly was to advantage the Democrats.
Well, and we're waiting for any action on automatic voter registration. That's something that you saw Illinois Republicans throw a bit of a fuss about on the floor. Some went along with it, as I recall, but others protesting the notion that was pushed by Democrats. But the group that was behind the effort that would basically say, you know, whenever you get a new or go to continue your driver's license, you go to the DMV, you're registered to vote automatically. It's an opt-out versus an opt-in. The promoters of that saying that this is something that has been accepted in other states by Republicans, but we are awaiting action on that. So I think there's that. And further, we have this week news you look at, obviously it's voters, but who's on the ballot, and a congressional candidate, David Gill, whose name we've heard before because he's failed in previous attempts when he was Democrats' candidate. Now he is running as an independent and taking to federal court at issue with Illinois' laws that he says are overburdensome in terms of the requirements for people that aren't one of the two major parties.
Yeah, and I want to point out, too, you know, we talk about this a lot in theory, about the theory of voter suppression and voter rights and all this stuff, and that's all well and good, but this has very practical implications in Illinois, especially for the Democrats. House Speaker Michael Madigan now has a three-fifths majority, a veto-proof majority in his chamber. He has exactly 71 votes. That is exactly the number you need to override a gubernatorial veto. Now, he also had a member, Kate Clunan, in Kankakee, who won by a razor, razor thin margin last time. And you're talking about, I believe it was 110,000 people used same-day voter registration in the primary. When you're talking about extremely close races like the one in Kankakee, this could have an impact on that. It really could. It could take away, for example, if a Republican comes up with the 50, 60 votes that might have brought that seat to the Republicans 2 years ago, then that could take away Speaker Madigan's supermajority, which would have a real impact on the way the General Assembly functions in the next session. So we're not just talking about voter theory here, but there is some, you know, there's a very practical effect if the judge rules that, yeah, this is unfair and puts a hold on it, you know, it really does have some potential to have a big effect.
Well, we will keep tracking this lawsuit and keep updating you on it on a future edition of State Week. Time now for notes from the field. We've got only about 15 seconds each. Amanda Vinicky.
Just because you teased us at the beginning there, Treasurer Mike Frerichs out this week with the news that despite the stopgap budget, Illinois is still missing out on investment dollars because he's not able to, you know, take out long-term investments due to uncertainty about the state's finances.
Matt Dietrich.
Keep an eye out as the TV ads start rolling, because I think the two biggest candidates in the state elections are going to be the ones who aren't on the ballot in a statewide way, and that's Bruce Rauner, who is going to be the all-purpose villain that all Democratic candidates will use, and House Speaker Michael Madigan, who only gets only the people who are in his House district get to vote for him, but he is going to play a role in every Republican challenger's ads.
And Kent Redfield.
And if you have time, take a look at the article in Cranes that ran this week on the brain drain caused by the underfunding of higher education. The lasting damage is really going to come from the people that don't come here and the people that leave early because of the chaos. And so, some, you know, this is having an impact not just on the Chicago State, but it's having an impact on the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champain. Potential for real long-term damage.
That is our time for this edition of State Week. Thanks to Matt Dietrich of Reboot Illinois and Kent Redfield of the University of Illinois Springfield. You can get a podcast of this show at nprillinois.org or on the NPR One app. I'm Brian Mackey.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.